So it is Wednesday, September 29th, 2010. Ethics. And so we're talking about basic ethical theories. We're just going to briefly go over chapter 1 and then move right into some of the material in chapter 2. Just a reminder, if you want to participate in class, please project from the diaphragm. Speak loudly, because we have a whole cadre of online students who will be hanging on your every word. So we had three questions last time. And I collected all the questions, and I'll get those back to you next week. I'm still reading through them. So the three questions: one is ethics real, or does ethics, you put it another way, does ethics express truths? And so, depending on how you answer that question, you're either going to be a realist, or you're going to be an anti-realist, or we could also call this skepticism, or nihilism. And this is nihilism. Nihilism, from the Latin word nihil, means nothing. Believe in nothing. So, moral anti-realism, moral skepticism, moral nihilism says that morality is an illusion, that it's something which is socially constructed, that it's not a valid or legitimate enterprise, that morality is for chumps and losers, or it's a byproduct of evolution, but it's nothing that can be rationally justified, nothing which expresses propositional truths, nothing which you can call knowledge. And so that's the skeptical position. So if that's your view, you think that, now you might still think that morality affects the way people behave. And you might think that it's a big part of society. You just say that it's not something that's part of the real world. And think about, another way of thinking about this is, you can call this moral atheism. So, you know, atheism is a belief there is no God. Now, you can be an atheist and recognize that religion and, you know, belief, even belief in a generic God, has strong effects on people's actions. Right? Causes people to do all sorts of things. Religion has a huge effects on the way society works. You just believe there is no such being as God. But you recognize that people show up at, you know, buildings to pray and sing hymns to this being, and they believe in the afterlife, and that affects their actions, and they have all kinds of beliefs, and people even, you know, die for their faith, even today. And so religion has a powerful effect. You just think there isn't any such being. And so similarly, the moral nihilist or the skeptic thinks, yes, you know, people have these beliefs in right and wrong, good and evil, and people make judgments every day about what's fair and unfair, about what's just and unjust, about what's good and bad. And it's just that it doesn't really apply to anything. And so we'll be talking about that actually next week. But if you think that morality is a real thing, that there are moral truths, then you're a moral realist. You think that there is such a thing as morality. And this, I suppose, might be analogous to believing there is a God. Now, there's two kinds of realism. And this is on a chart on page 5, 56, somewhere early on in the first chapter. Page 6. So we have realism and anti-realism. I have a motivism there. A motivism is a particular kind of moral nihilism, which we'll talk about later. But you can, under realism, there's relativism. And then there is absolutism, or sometimes also called universalism. So someone want to tell me, what's the difference between these two views here? What's the difference between a relativist and an absolutist? Yes, sir.
Relative is based off interpretation, can be adjusted, whereas absolute is basically set and it's not regarded by perspective.
What do you mean by interpretation?
Relative speaking, like if person were to look at something and say, that is wrong. If another person comes and looks at it, if ethics is, you know, relative, another person can look at it and say, that's not wrong. And for that person, it's not wrong because it's relative.
Right, so an absolutist can recognize that people can differ in their moral judgments, right? That people interpret moral situations differently and come to different conclusions. They would just say that some of those people are right and some of those people are wrong. So a relativist says that each person is right, depending on what? What makes moral judgments different for different people?
Circumstances, moral code, or...
You said circumstances. If you're an absolutist, if you think certain things are right and certain things are wrong, isn't that going to depend on what the circumstances are? Like if I shoot a little old lady to take her purse, that would be one thing. If I shoot Hitler to keep him from taking over the world, that's like a different thing, right? Even though they're both the same act of, like, you know, an act of killing. It seems like the circumstances still matter if you're an absolutist. Somebody else? There's another answer there simply. What makes things different for... what the relativist is going to say that right and wrong depend on what? Yeah, Evan.
Either culture or individual values.
Yeah, so you have two kinds here. You have cultural relativism, and this says that the measure is what the majority of a society either believes or practices. And people differ on what you go with. I'm just going to leave this loose here because, you know, Americans say they believe in, you know, fidelity and marriage. But you look at the adultery, how many people commit adultery and how many people get divorced and so on. So sometimes people's ideals differ from their behavior. So some people say go with what their ideals are, even if they fall short of them. Other people say you just got to look at what people do to see what they really believe, or see what their values are. Sorry, that you don't look at your beliefs even for what they do. But you might have a combination of both. And so cultural relativism says that whatever the majority of society believes or practices is right for it. And not necessarily for another society. The society has developed different ways of doing things, and that we have different social mores that evolved in different societies. And so, whatever the majority says in your particular group is right for you, but it's illegitimate for you to take your group's rules and impose them on some other group. What's the other way you can go with this? Subjectivism, or I'll put subjectivism here. So subjectivism, or individual relativism, says that it's really each person is a law unto themselves, as it were. That you are the measure of your own value system. That it's your conscience, and it's your individual code of ethics, and that each person has their own code of ethics, and that society can't tell a person what they should believe or what they should practice or what they should do in certain situations, that each person has their own moral code. Now, and so they would say, well, that might be true for you, but that's not true for me. And abortion might be wrong to you, but it's not wrong to me. And so people will say that morality is relative to the individual. And so these are both still forms of moral realism. They say morality is a legitimate enterprise. There are certain things are right and wrong, but they're right or wrong for either certain societies or certain individuals. And what's right for one individual might not be right for another individual, but there still are things such as right and wrong. It's just that they vary from person to person. Whereas the nihilist or the skeptic or the anti-realist says there's nothing to it. It's all a bunch of bunk. That it's an illusion. And then under absolutism or universalism, we have all kinds of other theories, which we'll be actually spending the bulk of class talking about. So those are all the main ones, egoism, utilitarianism, deontology, virtue ethics. And I think maybe Nietzsche too, although Nietzsche's kind of a hard person to interpret, that to categorize. He's kind of his own thing. But all these seem to be different forms of absolutism or universalism. Nietzsche, universalist. We'll get to that at the end. I'm going to consider Nietzsche has certain concepts like the will to power, which I think he thinks about as being universal. It's just that some people are unlucky enough to be born as having not very little will to power, and other people are born to be great individuals, and it's a matter of your heredity and biology. So even though Nietzsche does say some things which make him seem kind of relativistic or even nihilistic, I think I'll stick him there for now. Blake?
By what criterion do the anti-realists govern their actions if they think that morality is unwarranted or useless? I mean, how do they put their actions in perspective of their environment?
Good question. What do you think? So how, if you don't believe in morality, like how would you guide your actions? What principles would you use if not the principles of right and wrong, good and evil, just and unjust?
It seems like the nihilist would just be egoist because they probably just do things that make themselves a better life and things that cause themselves.
That's all. So just to repeat, so people listening online can hear. So it seems that an egoist would just follow. It seems that a nihilist would just follow self-interest. He would be an egoist, and this is why egoism is kind of like a tough one to categorize too. Because some people would say, "Oh, since there's no such thing as morality, I'll just follow self-interest." But then some people will say, "No, what should I do today? What do I have the right to do? Or what's right and wrong? Well, what's right is what's in my self-interest. What's wrong is anything that's against my self-interest." So some other people would put it here. So there's this kind of ambiguity in whether an egoist is saying, since there is no other standard beyond my self-interest, I'm going to follow self-interest, or whether they're saying, well, what's good is what's good for me, which is or what's in my interest. So is it a moral theory that says that good and right have to do with self-interest, or is it a nihilistic theory that says since there is no such thing as morality, which has to do with like helping other people or respecting other people's rights, whatever that means, I'm just going to follow self-interest? So it's so I suppose it might be just a semantic disagreement.
It seems like the nihilist or the anti-realist would be like more following towards your own feelings without the actual sticking to one of those groups, basically drinking from all those cups, so to speak. So you follow egoism here, you follow the golden rule here. It's just based on your own, however you feel like it, not necessarily for your own betterment of yourself, but it's just like, you know, doubling everything, but not necessarily believing there is one specific, you know, rule governing your morality.
Well, if you're a nihilist, though, why would you? Do you want to respond to that, Evan?
How does moral realism solve that? Even if there is a realm of morality or some moral code that we should all follow, well, how do we follow that code? How do we know that code is there? You could just be following your own emotions, regardless of whether there's a moral realm or not. The moral realm could say that, you know, raping and pillaging is completely okay, but we just don't feel that that's right.
I think your point is that without any sort of guiding principle, you kind of like see the world as a smorgasbord and you kind of pick what you like? Is that?
It's, well, you have your feelings, like the textbook says, like you have your feelings towards things. Like you have your feelings towards, let's say, abortion. You have your feelings towards the war. You have your feelings towards helping the elderly cross the streets, the puppies, you know,
right,
whatever.
Right.
And you just follow them, not necessarily. Like egoism is all about yourself. Well, if you're doing the golden rule, you're more like, you know, letting the old ladies cross the roads. It's not really egoism. You'll sacrifice your time volunteering just because that's, you feel like it. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what, not necessarily your cultural upbringing, but it's just that's the way you are. But it's, so you don't necessarily stick to egoism. You're not doing the social contract. You know, necessarily. So you don't really belong to any one of the relativism or absolutist groups. Just kind of just.
Well, you're not a relativist or an absolutist because those are both forms of realism, and you're rejecting morality. And it's like if yeah. I say like, what are your political views? Are you a Democrat or a Republican? And you're like, well, I don't really believe in government. Well, there's no question about whether you're a liberal or a conservative. It's just you're. I mean, you might say you're an anarchist, but maybe an anarchist is kind of like a political nihilist.
I guess in my thing, it would be like I don't follow the original reason for my social. For my moral concept, there is no underlying reasoning for it, or underlying, you know, there is no underlying reasoning for the moral compass. It's however I feel like it, but not necessarily in egoist sense of the word.
So I suppose that we might rephrase the question. Like you can look at this in two ways. One way might be, well, how would a moral skeptic live his life if he was going to be rational? I would say, if the moral skeptic was going to be rational, he would say, well, the way I live my life is I'm going to live according to self-interest, what's good for me, what makes me happy, what's giving me pleasure, what makes me feel fulfilled. But, I mean, people aren't always rational. People do things that aren't in their self-interest all the time. People, you know, smoke cigarettes, and they, you know, eat too much, and they do, get into bad relationships, and so people can compromise their. I mean, people don't always do what's in their own self-interest. But it seems that you come back to self-interest. Now, self-interest might have something to do with your feelings. So I asked this, and actually we might be getting a little ahead of ourselves because moral skepticism is next week. But you might just think about, like, if you didn't believe in morality, how much would your behavior change? Would you suddenly become a disloyal friend and, you know, stab your best friend in the back, slink around in alleys looking for old ladies to mug to take their money? Or, you know, maybe the best way to... Maybe you just keep on doing the things that you're doing right now. Except for maybe you wouldn't feel guilty for not calling your mother because, you know, she's a bitch. You just don't like talking to her. Whether before you talk to her, I have a sense of duty. Maybe you're like, well, yeah, I feel a little guilty, but I don't feel that guilty. So, I get along great with my mother, but other people I know don't. So, but you know, people. Go ahead, sir.
I don't understand the concept because somebody can operate without moral or ethics just simply based on cause and effect. Like, if you kill somebody, he might go to jail. He doesn't want that, so he's not going to kill for that cause and effect. There's no moral or ethical decision there. It's just to survive in this society.
Sure, yeah. I mean, why don't I go out, you know, looting and pillaging and killing if I don't believe in morality? Because I don't want to go to jail, because I want to keep my friends, because I got a nice job, you know. There's all sorts of reasons why you wouldn't engage in antisocial behavior just because it would be bad for you. And some people think that's like enough to justify morality, is that we you know, human beings are social animals and we like living in groups and we have these emotions that where most normal people feel guilty when they do something bad to someone, and we like people to like us, maybe that's good enough. So anyway, these are all the different the main views in ethics. So today we're going to talk about relativism. And to start off, I gave you the essay, Montaigne's essay of cannibals. So let me give you a hypothetical situation. I'll take a straw poll here. So imagine that the culinary program decided to engage in a new experiment in sustainability. And they're going to begin serving human flesh. Now, none of these human beings who were killed for the program, they were all volunteers. Some of them had terminal diseases. Or, you know, you might assume that if you believe in capital punishment, maybe some of them were justly executed prisoners who were, you know, convicted beyond a shadow of a doubt and committed heinous crimes and so on. Or they were people with terminal diseases, but, you know, they made sure the meat is safe and it's, you know, it's not, they cut out all the cancer. And so assume that it's healthy, that it's going to be delicious, and it's going to be served at a reasonable price. And no humans were no one was killed who wouldn't otherwise have died, and no one was just unjustly treated. So would you partake out of curiosity or just to see what it tastes like, or would you avoid it? What do you think? How many people would ask for a plate in the cafeteria of human flesh? Okay, how many people would, no way they would ever eat it? Okay, those of you that said no, why not? What's so bad? Okay. What was that? No, I missed that. What was the comment?
He's a vegan.
Oh, the vegan, okay. Now, see, if you're a vegan, like I'm a vegetarian, but I think it's like the way people treat factory farm animals is horrible, so... But, you know, if you could grow meat in a lab, you know, I don't see there any problem with that. So it's just like it's the suffering and the killing. But if no one suffered and no one died to produce this meat, I mean, somebody died, but they would have died anyway. Right? Maybe suppose the sales of the human flesh goes to feed the homeless. Or maybe you're going to serve the meat to the homeless, right? So, I mean, what would be wrong with that? Now, some people would say... Now, did you know that some cultures actually engage in ritual cannibalism when a relative passes away? Like, you know, when grandma passes away, they'll cook up her parts in the stove, and people will eat them in a ceremony, and it's seen as a way of remembering that person, of taking a part of that person's spirit into yourself. And it's seen as a somber and beautiful ceremony. Now, why is that? Why is that when I suggest the idea of like eating another human being here, people go, ugh. Or people giggle nervously or think it's like really weird, but, you know, some cultures it's a sacrament. Yeah?
I kind of feel like it's disrespectful. I guess if you volunteered yourself, but I don't feel like most people want to eat.
Well, suppose you have the consent of every person that's eaten.
Well, I guess someone necessarily will. It
probably tastes like chicken, right?
Yeah. Well, if everything tastes like chicken, what does chicken taste like?
Good question. There's an old Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial, I think, where they're making fun of their competition. I think the quote was, parts is parts. So you think about it, it's, you know, it's all muscle flesh anyway. It's, you know, it tastes the different variations, but it's nutritious and delicious, yeah.
I think possibly one of the reasons why people have a hard time with cannibalism is I think it's kind of like a slippery slope where if you acknowledge that it's okay to eat people and you start viewing people as a food source, you tend to dehumanize individuals over time. And so I think a lot of people are uneasy because it might end up backfiring on them where they might become a food.
So there's sort of associations where you kind of think that maybe long-term it leads to bad values about people. Yeah, I suppose you might say that. But it seems like if you just say this is one sort of narrow thing you're doing. Yeah.
Western civilization is pretty much opposed to it because you can relate to the steak.
Because you can what?
You can relate to the steak. You can know that's a human being that has the same feelings and emotions as you, and so people in Western society tend to view it as inappropriate.
Well, but if the person doesn't mind being eaten.
Well, it's still the squeamishness of the person eating it.
But why don't people feel squeamish about eating animals? I see people, they have like, maybe a pit bull or a bulldog that's got like this really short nose and snout, and maybe the dog like sleeps next to the bed on him, you know, and snores all night. And yet, you know, they'll be eating bacon for breakfast in the morning. And you take a pig, one of those pot-bellied pigs, and you put it next to like a pit bull or a pug or a bulldog or something like that, and little Frenchy bulldog. I mean, there's not a lot of difference between level of intelligence, level of consciousness, the affection. I mean, they're both these sort of highly evolved mammals, but one of them is considered to be, you know, delicious and nutritious. But if you ask that person about eating a dog, they're like, ew. Or they'd say, or they'd probably even get mad if someone talked about, like, look at like Michael Vick and his dog fighting thing, right? People think about him as being like worse than a child molester, but they look at the way, you know, a factory farm, and they're like, oh well, you know, people gotta have their bacon, so I don't care how the animals are treated. And in some ways it seems kind of irrational, and it's just a product of the way, you know, Western culture evolved. On the other hand, if you look at some other societies, the idea of eating a pig, it would create equal revulsion. You had your hand up for a while.
Yeah. Well, in Western civilization, like we've been taught, like, we're the top of the food chain. You know, you don't eat something that you can master. Like, it's such a foreign concept to us. We don't eat each other. We never have. It's never been introduced to us and that kind of thing. It's kind of like a shock to even say that because it's not a part of our culture whatsoever. And because, mm-hmm. We are kind of like the top of the food chain. Nothing eats us. We don't eat each other. We eat what's below us.
So maybe it reinforces our notion of superiority. Now, how about, like, think about, like, all you pro-choicers out there. So we have, like, these two problems, right? We have, like, all these unwanted fetuses that women want to get rid of that, like, cost a lot of money to get rid of as medical waste. And, you know, there's all sorts of, like, government rules and regulations. It's really expensive to get rid of all those fetuses. On the other hand, we have all these hungry people, you know, and more and more as the economy goes bad, right? So why don't we take, like, all these first trimester aborted fetuses and turn them into a nutritious food for the homeless? Why, you kill two birds with one stone. What would be wrong with that? I mean, they're going to die anyway, right? As the woman's made her right to choose. And so it's just going to be medical waste. Even if you're, like, actually pro-life, as long as you're not going to encourage women to have abortions in order to feed the homeless, you know, as long as you're not doing that, it seems like that would be a good thing because you're taking, yeah, I mean, you're doing something that's, it's, you know, recycling, right? Sustainability. Yeah, what would be wrong with that? Yeah.
I feel like it would be having two pet dogs and one dog older than the other, and if it dies one day and you come home and you see your other pet dog eating it, it'd make you sick to your stomach because that's something they love. And I feel like humans love human company more than anything else.
I guess most people do, yeah. Although some people love their cats, I think, more than other people or their dogs. I think some women love their cats more than they like men. I've known some people like that. Yeah, but isn't that kind of an irrational emotional attachment, though? That you happen to value other human beings more than animals? It's just kind of an association. And some animals, like, are food, and other animals are pets. Like, think about the uproar over, like, horse meat. There are all these wild horses in Nevada, and they're like rounding them up, and some of them, I think, are going off to France or something to be eaten at fancy French restaurants. And they're doing this in California. California actually passed a law that said that you cannot export horses for consumption. And that seems kind of funny that you can't eat horses, but cows are perfectly okay. And the difference between a cow and a horse, you know, isn't all that much. See, way in the back of Blake, and then...
I think that there's, like, a little bit of a difference between, it's like, something that provokes an emotional response, like shock or disgust, and something that we believe is, like, morally or ethically wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you were talking about feeding people to people in the cafeteria, that, like, you describe the situation by which they get there as being completely principled and ethical and fair, but still most people said they probably wouldn't do it. Well, I mean, is it ethically wrong to do it? Maybe not. Does that mean that it can still disgust you and shock you? Yeah, I mean, that's just two different kind of responses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And it might be that a lot of these cultural differences are just a matter of what you're used to, and what shocks and disgusts you isn't necessarily something that's immoral. Good point. Yeah.
Actually, speaking of the porches in the United States, you guys had porches for sale as a canned meat in like back in the 1960s. That was just was normal here.
Uh-huh.
I think you guys in like 1970s, your USDA decided not to no longer okay meat for the consumption. But before that, yeah.
Yeah, society's changed over time too. So if you look at like the cannibal culture, Montaigne is really interested in this idea. I think he mentions that you look at Herodotus actually started out with this. The Greek historian Herodotus. Herodotus. So Herodotus compared the Greeks and the Persians with their burial customs. And for the Greeks, it was burial, and for the Persians, it was cremation. And he said that it was really, he said, culture is king, and the Greeks considered it to be a great dishonor to be burned or cremated, have the corpse cremated. And the Persians consider it to be a great dishonor to be dropped into the ground to rot. And both of them thought it was like the worst thing in the world to have the opposite thing happen. And so he is just noting this and just how strangely attached people are to their customs, where it seems like, well, if you're dead, you're dead. And what happens to your corpse, whether it goes to dust and, you know, whether it goes to ashes in 10 minutes or, 10 centuries, it's... it's going to decompose, and what's the real difference? And Montaigne kind of takes this question and is comparing the cannibal culture, this Aboriginal cannibal culture, with European culture, and doing a little compare and contrast and trying to make sense out of the fact that people seem really attached to their way of doing things. Yeah?
On the cannibalism thing, I mean, you being a vegetarian, probably wouldn't really want to eat weeds or hay or grass clippings. You could probably survive, but we as humans, we value what we put in our bodies, and when we don't have to eat human flesh, as we don't have to because there's plenty of resources out there for us to eat, we're not going to eat human flesh. There are many instances where, you know, on boats and whatnot, people have had to eat human flesh in order to survive and done it, which, you know, a lot of people can understand.
Right.
To actually eat human flesh when you don't have to eat it or not, you know, your back's not up against the wall, I think is
Well, you don't have to eat bacon either, though, right? I mean, you don't have to eat any animal.
But if it tastes good and that's what you want to put in your body, then that's what you want.
Well, what if the human flesh tastes really delicious or tastes just as good as some other thing? I mean, what if it just tastes good? Why would there be anything wrong with eating it, is the question. Yeah.
It's just cultural indoctrination. It's not necessarily wrong there. It's just our culture doesn't believe in it.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much one of the things Montaigne says is that people think that the way that they do things and the way their culture does things is normal. And what other people do is weird. And when you are judging another culture's practices, you judge them typically by the way your culture does things, and to the extent that they're similar to you, the way they do things is the right way or the good way, and to the extent that they deviate from the way your culture does things, they're doing things the wrong way or the bad way. And so what are some of the things let's compare the cannibals with the Europeans. He makes some observations. What are some of the differences between their cultures that Montaigne mentions here? Anybody remember some? Evan and then Blake.
Distribution of goods.
Okay, so what was the deal in the cannibal culture?
The cannibals would take whatever they gathered home and then divide it up between everyone. You didn't go out to war and then just take whatever you wanted for yourself. Whereas Europeans, there was this idea of property and you know, whatever you made, you got to keep. And, you know, if you had a lavish house, you know, and lots of food, you wouldn't give anything to a begging homeless man.
Shared resources. Whereas the Europeans, this idea of they had a they call it a stratified society. And, you know, rich, very rich, and very poor. And remember there's a story where he talks about some of the cannibals take a little trip to Europe, and they see all these poor people, the beggars, and people dressed in rags outside the houses of rich people begging for scraps. And what they said is, look, the poor people outnumber the rich people. Why don't they just, you know, storm their houses and take what they need? Why do they sit around and beg for scraps? They didn't get it. Blake.
Talks about the difference in treatment of prisoners. Like,
uh-huh.
Cannibals took a prisoner from a rival tribe hostage. Like fed him and clothed him for 2-3 months and had him hang out with the family and stuff. And the prisoner held their captor in high.
Okay, a little louder because you're being knocked out by the fan there.
Held the prisoner in high esteem.
Uh huh.
You know, when they killed him, he was like almost ready to die. Or versus the European Count Montaigne talking about how we kill people so disproportionately brutally compared to how they've slighted us. And the cannibals observed, I think, if I read it right, that, you know, man, they must have messed with you guys in some super serious way for you to do what you do to them compared to what they do to us.
Fed well. They're kept in this kind of pen, and he describes this witty repartee that goes back and forth between the prisoner and the captors, and the as they fat the guy up and get ready to eat him, they say, oh, you're going to be so delicious, and the other guy says something like, oh, I hope you choke on me, or, you know, they have this thing that goes back and forth, and he talked about the bravery and honor, and the guys who are going to be killed, fed well, and then, you know, humanely killed, they're just quickly executed, whereas the European prisoners, dungeons, right, poorly treated, torture. And he mentions this too, that in the Europeans, you know, what do they do? Punishment for heresy. I'll just put, you know, basically politics and religion. I'll just put religious, political crimes. Whereas here, that it's prisoners in, you know, a fair fight is the way Montaigne sees it. So he says, look, here's what the cannibals do. They all get together for war. They fight the enemy tribe. If you're captured, it's understood that you go back to the enemy's camp. You sit in the pen for a while they fatten you up, and then they kill you and eat you. And everybody's okay with it. Whereas you look at the Europeans, they grab some poor guy off the street because he has the wrong religious beliefs or because he happens to be aligned with the guy that got booted out the last time he killed the user here.
Actually registering on your little sound.
Yeah, it is. I just hear that maybe I have a thing about bees. I don't know. It reminds me of killer bees. So, anyway, you know, they'll persecute people for their political beliefs or because they're aligned with the wrong, you know, despot. And then they end up being thrown in the dungeon, and then you get put in the rack, or they pour like molten lead into your ear, or they like tie ropes to all four of your limbs, and they tie those to horses, and then they like make the horses go and pull you apart, or just did also. I mean, there's a instrument of torture by the Inquisition called the rectal pair. You use your imagination. It's just like horrible ways of killing people, whereas. Here it's just, you know, it's a quick cut across the throat, just like you'd slaughter an animal and it's over. And so Montaigne says, which is more barbarous, to torture somebody to death in a deep, dank dungeon for having the wrong religious beliefs, or to take a prisoner of war and to humanely execute him and eat his flesh? And I think the implication there is that it's the Europeans who are the real barbarians. The cannibals are, he sees as being sort of noble. Comments? Professor Safar, yes, sir.
Yeah, there was one other big difference. That was
a little louder, please.
In the exploits of war, once the cannibals won, they didn't take goods and things from the loser. They just carcass the person.
Right.
And that seemed to be really deep in the culture.
Greed, looting. We're here, they fight. He talks about these megalomaniacal kings that fight for riches, land, wealth. Where he thinks it's great, where the cannibals fight for the honor, for honor and glory.
Now you might think that fighting for honor and glory is to equally, you know, bad. But at least Montaigne has this idea that fighting over, you know, trifles, essentially fighting because you want to take somebody's land or take somebody's stuff or plunder their goods, that's kind of base and pedestrian. Fighting for the glory of conquest and for victory and to show your military prowess and demonstrate your skills as a warrior, that's noble. And so he thinks the cannibals have one up on the Europeans in that respect. Sorry, you have to talk really, really loud. I can't even hear you.
You mentioned how they were anonymous in relationships and wives and wives and had, and you said they're that he himself thought it was bad.
So you're talking about the cannibals had many wives?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he thought that was perfectly okay, and that everybody seemed to get along, and there wasn't jealousy. Yeah. So, polygamy. Did you know that even though gay marriage is perfectly okay and legal, I can't remember what, I don't know what the latest machinations is. I could say that gay marriage thing gets really complicated. But I think in many states, I'll say, where gay monogamy and a gay marriage or a civil union is perfectly okay, polygamy is still illegal. So if you're a man, it's illegal for you to be married to more than one woman at the same time, even though you could be married to another man if you wanted, or have a civil union or what have you. Yeah. I think it doesn't matter the sex, it's the oneness that matters. Bigamy or polygamy, bigamy is two, so bigamy is a form of polygamy where it's just one more than you're supposed to have. And it's illegal in all 50 states. There's still laws in the book. Now, it's not really enforced typically. Usually you have to do something else and get in trouble with the law or have, it's sort of, a scam to get, welfare or something like that, then you can get in trouble. Typically, it's not prosecuted. But it is, it used to be more prosecuted. Women have this huge welfare state, and women would rely on their husband for support more, and there weren't a lot of women in the workforce. Now it just sort of sits in the books unenforced. But it's still illegal to have more than one wife in the United States, and most people consider polygamy to be bad. And they think about, people think polygamy is bad, and they're perfectly okay with gay marriage, which to me is kind of interesting. Whereas there's lots of other cultures that practice polygamy. Even the biblical patriarchs practice polygamy. You can read about it in the Old Testament. Yeah?
Well, why is that interesting? Because with gay marriage, you're still married to another person. Whereas polygamy, you're just married to multiple.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. What's interesting to me is that although gay marriage is legal, polygamy is still illegal. It just seems, if it doesn't matter what the gender is, why does the oneness, if the opposite genders doesn't matter, why does the oneness matter? I don't know, maybe we're getting off into a side thing. But polygamy and monogamy. So now the question The main question is, why is Montaigne listing all these differences? Let me ask that. A lot of what Montaigne likes to do is kind of muse about things that he finds interesting. So his Montaigne's essays are him kind of reflecting on things that he's experienced or heard about or read. And it's not like reading David Hume or John Stuart Mill, where it's like, here's my thesis and here are all the reasons why I believe it and here are all the counterarguments of the opposition. It's like, here's some interesting stuff and I wonder about this and wow, this is kind of interesting. And he doesn't really tell you what he thinks. But if you had to read this, would you think that does Montaigne seem to be a relativist? What do you think? Yes or no and why? Evan?
I don't think he's necessarily, he certainly could be. I think he's just kind of making interesting observations about different cultures and what they find acceptable.
Okay. So you think...
I don't think that necessitates that he thinks that morality is therefore relevant. He could think that there still is a universal morality, but different cultures are still value different things.
Okay. Yeah, anybody else? What do you think? Is he expressing a relativist thesis, or does he have some other kind of view? If you had to read between the lines, Blake.
He's arguing the potential that that relativist position could be feasible. He's also, like you said, could be a little bit arguing toward universal morality, because he's basically making it sound like he admires the lifestyle of his travel more than that of the Europeans, who he considers to be barbarous by comparison. So it's a good idea.
Yeah, I like what you said, that he's criticizing his own culture and seems to admire the cannibals in more ways. And I think if you had to read between the lines, and if I had to ferret out a thesis of Montaigne's essay here of cannibals, I'd have to say something like, I'll get one other person here. You had your hand up for a while.
He seemed to be willing to look outside the box and view other cultures and, kind of look at them.
Right. So he's willing to look outside of his culture and look outside the box and see. And I think if you had to pick, a sentence long thesis, I'd say that, you could ask it as a question, who are the real barbarians? Or you might say, Europeans are the real barbarians. Look at how we treat the poor. Look at how we treat our prisoners. Look at the things that we punish people for. And now look at these cannibals. And look how we're obsessed with material things. And now compare that with these cannibals who live close to nature, who share, who fight for the glory and honor of it, and to show their skill and prowess. Who have family values, even though they have a bunch of wives. And Europeans should be a little more broad-minded and not judge the cannibals before looking at the problems in their own culture. And so I think Montaigne seems to embrace a view which is called soft universalism, which is kind of an attempt to reconcile some of the intuitions behind moral relativism or cultural relativism in particular with the intuitions about universalism. And so soft universalism says there are certain absolute values, but they can be realized with different sets of cultural norms. So, for example, the idea that you should respect other people. And how should that respect be realized? And a soft universalist might say, the cannibal culture, you respect your prisoner by not going easy on him, by taunting him, and then he shows his bravery by showing his fearlessness, and then he's killed, and then you eat him, and you show your respect to him by killing him painlessly when it comes time to do it. And he might say the European culture maybe don't do things quite right with regard to the way they treat prisoners, and maybe they should treat them certain ways. But maybe the way to show respect a prisoner in European culture would be like to, you know, feed him decently and not torture him or something. But maybe the sort of back and forth and showing your bravery would be a part of that culture. Or just take another example, like in the polygamy example. In the European culture, you have a show respect for your wife by, and in Montaigne's time, you'd show it by taking care of her and your children. And this time you do show it by taking care of your multiple wives and their children. And so and it might be that in the case where polygamy is not the cultural norm, you show respect to your wife by not sleeping with other women, you're not married to. But it's just one. So it might be that. Let's say this the right way. In the polygamous culture, the wives might show respect to their husbands by not being jealous of the other wives. In the monogamous culture, maybe you show respect for your spouse by not lusting after other members of the opposite sex. So although there are absolute values about like respect and about how to treat other people and about how you should behave, it's within a cultural context. Just to take another example, like showing when you meet someone, you show respect by giving a greeting. In Asian cultures, you might bow. In Western culture, you shake hands. If you're over in Europe, you might, and it's a good friend, you might embrace them and kiss them on opposite cheeks, even if it's like another dude, right? Because that's what people do, right? You see in Italy, you see people greet each other. You grab them, kiss, right? And you're like, oh, that's kind of weird. Now, if you did that in America, if you're like meeting somebody or maybe some roommate and the guy comes up to you and you're not gay and the guy's like, I'm giving you this bear hug and they're like kissing you on your cheek and go, and you think that's kind of weird. So the idea is you don't do things that make people uncomfortable. But this idea that when you meet someone, you give a greeting, is just like a general principle. It's just that it is realized in different ways in different cultures. Same thing about the way people dress, or about other, customs. And another example, in some cultures, it's considered to be a sign of politeness if you belch after a meal. Here, it's considered to be rude, right? And so it just, how close when you speak to someone. In some cultures, it's you like get right up to the person's face and you're like this far apart when you're talking so you can feel like the person's breath on your face. Here, that's like way too close for comfort. People need like 3 feet of personal space unless you're, intimate with that person. So it just, it depends. So I think Montaigne has this idea that cultures have different ways, customs, and different ideas of how things should be done, and he's observing that it's part of human nature to think, my culture is right, and then to the extent that other cultures are the same, they're right, to the extent that they deviate from what I do and what my group does, they're wrong. And is just wondering about why Europeans are so judgmental of other cultures when they've got their own problems that they're blind to. How about this generally about the relativist position? How many people find the relativist position attractive? Anybody? Okay, a few people. How about some arguments, say, either for or against relativism? There might be some arguments for relativism. Let's start with the for. Need some pro arguments. Yeah?
It seems like relativism is just relativism. It seems like no one in personalism has made up some of this in time. It should have been written by large groups of people, but these large groups of people basically should have been able to do their opinions and what people should do. So, universalism seems like a larger version of subjectivism.
Okay, I'm just going to repeat what you said, which is that universalism has to come, the universal rules that everyone supposedly agrees on, have to come from somewhere. And so you think that it's more realistic to think that, well, we start out with all these different cultures, they all develop their different rules, and so this idea that there's some universal rule which applies to everyone seems to be kind of like a fiction. Is that...
Well, Well, it just seems like universalism is just a form of relativism, so that's
I'm not sure what universalism is. Just another form. Universalism says that there's one set of ethical principles which applies to everyone. Relativism says that each group has its own set of principles which applies to it alone. It doesn't necessarily apply to some other group. Although groups might share like certain principles. Like you might have two groups that might have some things in common. It's just that it's not necessarily true that the same rules apply to everyone. So you couldn't say that universalism is just another form of relativism with those definitions. So I'm not sure what you're getting at.
I just don't see how universalism can be objective and it's
not made by human beings. Okay. So that's, you can't see why universalism would be objective when it's made up by human beings.
Yeah, it's human beings that lie.
Well, you're assuming that the rules of morality are made up by human beings, I suppose. And universalists wouldn't necessarily accept that. Well, there's a lot of different theories about where they come from, and we'll get to that later in the course. The same thing is true of relativism, though, I suppose. Now, actually, when we get to Martin Luther King, we'll actually come up to that question. Yeah.
It's sort of an argument for relativism. In that universalists accept that situations apply, and I guess an argument would be, well, those apply, but in the situation of particular people and particular cultures.
Yeah, I kind of see what you mean there. So,
so there seems to be this acceptance of, well, it applies to all people without this reason in universalism. So maybe an argument for relativism is that, well, different people are different, and so those moral laws apply differently.
Yeah. Now, this is an interesting question about whether people whether we share a common human nature, or whether we're socially constructed, and each culture makes us into different kinds of people. And one argument maybe for universalism is that we do all share a common human nature, and we might be able to derive a set of values from that human nature, which is one of the things that Aristotle tries to do. We'll look at later in the term. And actually, I want to talk a little bit about the letter from a Birmingham jail, and maybe I'll leave the pro and con arguments for next week. So let's just
talk about Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham jail.
Now, why is that included in the section of relativism? Ask that. And what in his letter? How does he touch on this idea of relativism? Is there anything in there that talks about relativism? way in the back.
Well, it's kind of about cultural relativism.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the majority of the country might think that segregationism is okay, but the argument is not.
Yeah, so if relativism, and I think it's, if cultural relativism was true, then if majority thinks segregation, or we could put slavery based on race, or genocide based on race, the Nazis, is okay, then it is. He says that any moral theory which leads you to the conclusion that segregation is okay, slavery is okay, and genocide is okay, there's something wrong with that theory. And so he says moral relativism is not a tenable theory because it has these implications. Now, why does it have these implications? Well, he talks about Nazi Germany. The majority of Germans went along with Hitler. They believed in the master race. They wanted to take over the world. They believe in Nazi ideology. So if a majority of society believes something, does that mean that it's good, right, or true for them? And Martin Luther King says no. Just because you can get 50% plus one to say, I agree with this, that doesn't make something right.
Why should that make a thing right just because the majority agree with it? And so he says you can find historical cases where the majority of people in the United States thought slavery was okay. You know, the slaves were a minority group. You know, literally, I mean, there's fewer slaves than people that weren't slaves. And if you took a poll of all those people, including the slaves, the people who were slaves, people thought, oh, well, you know, slavery is okay. And you look at cases in Nazi Germany, the majority of people thought that the Jewish problem needed to be dealt with and that the Jews should be put in concentration camps. I think the gas chambers thing was kind of, it wasn't widely publicized, although people kind of sort of knew probably what was going on. But you might sort of have room for quibbling there. But certainly, the Nazi culture had institutionalized racism and institutionalized militarism and all sorts of bad values. Just because the majority went along with it doesn't mean those were good values for them. They were bad values, period. And this is why Martin Luther King suggests that you need he thinks divine command theory is the only way to go, because it's the only way you can have a transcendent standard which transcends all cultures and human values. And he associates this with natural law. And this is a traditional thing where people will say, well, morality gets its legitimization from a god, but it's cashed out in terms of what's good for human beings. And the idea is that God's a moral lawgiver, but he gives a moral law, which is in accord with human nature. Now, some people would say, we just get rid of the God thing and stick with the natural law, and we'll be okay. And that's, I guess, related to the term. But this idea of natural law, he says, what, every act that, everything that uplifts the human personality is right, and everything that degrades the human personality is wrong. And, you know, so this is kind of if you think about this as the kind of religious humanism. And so to the extent that segregation degrades people by treating them as lesser than on the basis of their race, on the basis of their national origin, that it's wrong. And because it degrades human persons and treats them as less than human and less than equal. So that's Martin Luther King's main point. And he thinks that your choice is relativism, cultural relativism, or it's the divine command theory. And he says that if you believe that morality is determined by what the majority say, you have to accept all these bad implications, where historically you can find lots of cases where the majority of the society believed in things which were really bad. Yeah?
Is that theory
the natural law does. This natural law and divine command theory have gone together since, like, basically Thomas Aquinas, who's a Christian theologian, and he adopted Aristotle as his kind of patron saint of philosophy and refers to him as the philosopher. And so in the Middle Ages, the greatest philosopher of the Middle Ages is Thomas Aquinas, and Aquinas is kind of the Bible plus Aristotle is his philosophy. And so you get this mixture of Christian and pagan philosophy, and that's why you get divine command theory and natural law. You see together a lot, and you find them in Martin Luther King together too. But I think his main point, I think it's a strong argument against relativism, is that if you accept that whatever the majority of a culture believes is ipso facto right, you're going to have to accept a lot of bad things. You're going to have to accept you know, a little girl having her clitoris cut off by Uncle Harry with a rusty knife. You're going to have to accept widows being expected to jump on their husband's funeral pyre and be burned alive. You're going to have to accept the persecution of religious minorities. You're going to have to accept the subjugation of women. There's all sorts of horrible things which are culturally and institutionally practiced throughout the world. And you look at all sorts of things. Any other examples people want to mention? Cultural practices where people are treated in horrible ways? Yeah.
It's not a horrible way. Chinese foot binding.
Foot binding, yeah, that's a great one. where they that this idea that women were like sexy if you like wrapped their feet in these bandages, so they were like crippled and the bones were all crushed, so that when they walked they had to kind of hobble along, and they thought the Chinese men thought it was really sexy the way they kind of hobbled along on their crippled feet. Kind of like an extreme version of like high heels, I guess, today, right? They thought like, that sexy little limp, you know, was great. And so you like cripple people for the pleasure of lecherous old men. Yeah.
Actually, one of the primary reasons why they do foot binding is that it was a social sign that the woman was high enough class where she didn't have to get around on her own. She had service. So it's like if you were poor class and you were working class, you couldn't have your feet cut because you had to go out and work. But if you had a ability or you had enough money, you wouldn't have to. Because having your feet tied, it was like proof that you didn't have to work.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's, you might say that just shows there's a bad economic system which controls people's ability to earn a living was behind that. There's always a reason for these things. These things don't, somebody doesn't wake up some morning and say, hey, I think I'll cut my good daughter's clitoris off with this rusty knife. She might die of the infection, but I think I'll just do it for no reason at all. But, you know, what's behind this? It's this idea that, you know, women are sluts and whores and you need to keep them from whoring around. And so what do? Well, you make sure they don't enjoy sex all that much. And then after a while, it gets inculcated into the culture. And then, you know, little girls will look forward to it because it's seen as the sign of womanhood. And if you haven't had this done to you, men don't desire you as a wife. You're seen as loose. Other people in the village look down on you, and an angry mob might storm your house and brutalize your family in order to do this to you. But I mean, also the women go along with it, much like you have battered wives. Will say they'll jump on the policeman's back and start beating him when the policemen are trying to subdue their violent husband, right? After they've just had the hell beaten out of them. And so girls will look forward to this because it's a sign of coming of age, and there are all these cultural things that tell them it's a good thing, even though it deprives them of the natural human pleasure, which is one of the natural pleasures in life that can be enjoyed, and it deprives them of that because of some negative view of women as sluts and whores and people who can't control their impulses. When really, in reality, it's the men that are like that, right? I mean, naturally, if you want to look at human nature, it's men who tend to be promiscuous naturally, and women actually tend to be more standoffish when it comes to being free about their sexuality. And on that note, let's end class on next week on Monday. We will we'll be going to moral skepticism. Make sure to post to the forum by before Sunday, 11:55 p.m. And make sure, of course, to log into Moodle by Thursday.